supply constrained markets with a high inbound migration that puts a lot of demand pressure on rents, but also affordability. What are the jobs in the market? What is the pay? Are wages growing? What is unemployment? Because if you hit the affordability ceiling, you know, you can't continue to raise rents if nobody can afford to pay them.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I'm very excited to introduce our amazing guests for the day, Ryan and Warren from Equity Yield Group. They've got a lot going on and really excited to hear what they're up to. So Ryan and Warren, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us. Great to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely. Well, I know we've got a lot of exciting things to talk about, but just as a heads up, Ryan and Warren are working on closing some really big deals in the multifamily space. And, you know, I'm excited to hear about your backgrounds and everything that you're working on. So why don't you start us off with one of you giving us a little bit about your background and how and why you got into real estate, and then we'll go to the next one.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'll go ahead and jump in here. So I've been in real estate one form or another most of my career. Prior to founding Equity Yield Group with Warren, I owned and operated a construction and development company. We got hooked up about 2 years ago and founded Equity Yield Group. And we focus on the acquisition of institutional quality multifamily assets that are well located in strong growth markets across the Southeast with a light to moderate value add component.
Okay, cool. And what was it, real quick, Ryan, that inspired you to move from, you know, where you were in real estate doing construction, et cetera, into holding multifamily real estate and renovating it, et cetera?
Really just risk mitigation. When you're on the new construction development side, you're a lot more susceptible to the market cycle and obviously oversupply and cost overruns and the debt market when it comes to financing development projects. The feasibility of that really comes down to the availability of debt.
Okay. And so have you transitioned fully into sort of value add real estate acquisitions, or are you doing anything in construction still?
Nope. Doing acquisitions full time now.
Okay. Very cool. Interesting perspective. Thanks. I mean, I know we all know that construction gets hit the hardest when a recession comes, and it's just it's harder to sleep when you're in that industry.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely a risk reward profile.
Yeah, I see. All right, cool. Well, what about you, Warren?
So my background's a little bit different to Ryan's. I've spent 20 plus years in the corporate world with a finance insurance background. I started investing in real estate with just buying and holding single family homes. Originally, it was for tax benefits and some passive income. Eventually, I discovered multifamily and actually started in multifamily as a passive investor. So just investing in other people's deals. And then around 2019, I decided I wanted to get more active. So started educating myself much more. I joined a mentorship group, which actually, you know, surrounded me with people who were doing this kind of stuff. And I started learning really quickly. That's where I met Ryan, and we started hunting for deals together and soon afterwards decided to partner up.
Very cool. I'm curious, Warren, if you wouldn't mind sharing what part of, you know, the corporate world were you part of? What industry were you in?
In the early days, it was banking, but then for most of my career, it was insurance.
Oh, right. You mentioned that. Mm-hmm. And just from that perspective I know it sounds like you were doing some real estate on the side. What was it that got you interested as a corporate person in investing in real estate and then moving to syndication, passive investing from that?
It was really the passive income. I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad really early on. I don't think I really absorbed it the first time I read it. I remember my dad gave it to me when I was really young, and All I remember from the first read was that a car is a liability, not an asset. But I never really thought about active income and passive income, and kind of just jumped into a career in the corporate world and started progressing there. But after a while, I realized I need to start building up passive income. And that was the main motivator and the driver for getting into real estate.
Yeah, it makes sense. The cash flow aspects of real estate are really powerful when it comes to being able to make choices about how you spend your time and what big life decisions you make along the way. Curious if your dad was a real estate investor, Warren.
No, actually, my dad was a stockbroker. And so I still have some interesting discussions with him, because I'm a huge believer and proponent of real estate and not investing in the stock market. But he spent all of his life in the stock market. So we have some interesting conversations. We agree to disagree on many things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is interesting, because clearly he wanted to instill some kind of values or mindset around finances. And obviously that book is from a real estate investor. So it's interesting, I guess, that there can be some overlap there.
Totally. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, cool. Well, you know, with Equity Yield Group, I'd love to hear what it is that you guys are working on right now. And just tell us a little bit about the history of your company.
You want to go ahead, Ryan?
Yeah, absolutely. And we got a number of irons in the fire here. We're always looking to acquire more properties, which has been interesting the last 30 days as we've watched the debt market shift and working to acquire deals and put bids out there that are at pricing that we know we can close 60, 90 days down the road. Outside of that, we're asset managing our existing portfolio, working towards a disposition of an asset here, hopefully in the near future.
Okay, cool. How about one of you tell us about your first acquisition?
I can do that. Sure. So the first one we bought was actually quite a big deal. It was a $26 million purchase, 148 units, Class A deal in Sarasota, Florida. A little bit different to the standard syndicator and the types of assets that they're going after. But we were always quite intentional about focusing on the kind of investment that both of us think is the best investment from a risk standpoint. So we sat down early on and thought, it's all about return and risk. Really, we're striving for risk-adjusted returns. And the more that we thought about it, the more we realized we actually want to be targeting the strongest markets, because we think the risk is lower. And we want to be targeting the better assets, the newer assets, because again, we think the risk is lower. There's less deferred maintenance. You're less likely to get issues with plumbing, with electrical. The demographic tends to be better on the newer assets. So we could see at the time, this was going back about 2 years now, but we could see at the time that we could generate great returns on these assets and the risk was lower. So the risk adjusted offering to our investors was better. And this first asset really fit into that framework. So it was a 2016 build, 148 units, like I said, and it was in a great market, a great growing market in Sarasota.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I'm curious how you're thinking about balancing that lower risk with the returns, because obviously that is one potential drawback to investing in these newer, nicer assets.
Sure. Well, the returns were slightly, firstly, I should take a step back. When we talk about returns, when we're buying an asset, it's all projected returns.
Sure.
So and we've got our underwriting and we build our model and we project what we think is going to happen with a prudent view. So we did that with this asset, and the cash on cash return was lower than what you might see in a C-class deal. So we were projecting an 8% cash on cash. A lot of investors are used to going for a 10% or 11% cash on cash. But when we were talking to our LPs, we tried to always mention these risk adjusted returns. 8% for an A-class deal is actually pretty good. What we've found in retrospect, because the market has been so strong,
yeah,
and is so strong, returns have been exceptional. So we're probably on the road to outperforming what we projected in the beginning. But yeah, based on the projections, it was slightly lower. Still a really healthy return, but slightly lower than what you might see on a riskier deal.
Yeah, for sure. I think that you bring up a lot of good points. Like, number one, there are definitely reasons to be in different types of asset classes that might offer slightly different return profiles. And the other thing is that, in terms of what people are projecting, it does actually still vary even between asset classes, right? Like, so projections are really just projections. And, as soon as the deal closes, they kind of go out the window, right? And the sponsors are just doing the best they can to deliver the best results for the investors. So understanding your sponsor's mentality, their track record, their philosophies, it's something that comes with experience. And yeah, so it's always helpful to hear people's perspective. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, no problem.
So Ryan, you mentioned, and so it's April 12th right now, Ryan, you mentioned that in the last 30 days, there have been some interesting changes in the debt market. Do you mind speaking to that? What are you seeing and how is that affecting what you're able to accomplish with the acquisitions that you want to make?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, interest rates are coming up, and this is something that, you know, we saw coming a long time ago. And when we purchased, you know, our owned assets, you know, we proactively bought very aggressive interest rate caps. We have 50 basis points caps on all of our deals with variable debt, which is kind of interesting because right now we're looking at these deals and the caps are worth, you know, triple, quadruple what we paid for them at that time. And we now have variable rate debt that is at a better interest rate than what you can get for market debt today, fixed or variable. But that does change things for acquisitions in the current environment. Obviously, a higher debt service does eat into cash flow. But particularly on value add deals, the other thing that you need to take into consideration is if you're planning to exit via refinance, you need to have some mind to what is that future interest rate going to be and what is the DSCR cover going to be? Because that's going to limit your potential refi proceeds in the future. We're in the environment of the last 12, 24 months, everything was LTV constrained and you could almost assume 70-75% leverage on a fixed rate agency refi. That's not going to be the case going forward.
For sure. So a couple of things that I want to circle back on are, what are you seeing in terms of interest rate increases, you know, basis points difference from now versus say last year when you're closing deals?
I mean, especially on the bridge product, it's really about spreads. And we closed a $73 million deal back in December at a 285 spread over SOFR. Today, you know, we're getting quotes at 340 over SOFR. And I expect with the index moving in May again, that we'll see that come up even further. And on the fixed rate side, you know, treasuries have come up significantly. You know, fixed rate debt is, depending on leverage point and product type, you know, you're anywhere from, you know, 4.3 up to 5.1.
Uh-huh. I see. Okay. Well, thanks for that overview. Appreciate it. And would like to also ask how you're then coping with, I mean, are you not budgeting in refinances into your underwriting pro formas? Or how are you handling that at this time?
Yeah, at this time, we're not assuming a refinance. You know, that would be, you know, a good thing, kind of cherry on top if we happen to hit a trough when interest rates and spreads come back down. But we're not running that in our business model currently. We just plan on running our debt at acquisition out through the term.
Okay. And so if I understand correctly, so then were you assuming refis at a different point in the market cycle?
Yeah. Again, a project by project basis. Some projects lend themselves to a refinance where you have you know, a good value add component and you're able to really increase NOI to get a favorable refinance.
Okay. So in certain circumstances, you would be able to reasonably put that in there. Okay. Now I want to ask about your growth as a company. It sounds like your first deal was a fairly large deal at $26 million. And then you also closed on another close to like $100 million of real estate last year. I'd love to hear how, you know, how you've been accomplishing that, putting the capital stack together, getting access to these deals, et cetera.
It's, I mean, I don't know exactly. Looking back, I mean, we made great progress in 2021. So we bought around $130 million of real estate in 2021. But really, the hard work started probably 9 months before that. So we were underwriting, I don't even know how many deals, 100, 200 deals, constantly getting rejected. Often we're competing with institutions in buying these deals, and it's very hard to beat them when they're bidding against you. So we're very used to coming in second or last. So there was a lot of persistence, a lot of discipline, a lot of just underwriting, talking to brokers, touring properties. The other thing that's a really important component of our strategy is, given that we were targeting these bigger deals, we knew that we needed some help on the equity side. So we were very conscious about trying to build relationships with institutional partners. And again, that whole process started 6 to 9 months before we ever found that first deal. And I think the fact that we started to build that track record of talking to these companies, I think that was a huge contributor to our success and our ability to close these bigger deals, because yeah. that one was pretty large, but the next couple afterwards were even bigger. And so those relationships came in really handy.
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-cap.com, and sign up for our newsletter. There's a lot that I want to touch on there. The first one I would say is the underwriting of deals and going for deals and then, you know, eventually persevering and winning a deal, like your first one, for example. So what were some of the things that you learned along the way as you were underwriting deals and putting in offers? And I mean, do you think it was a combination of that plus just like a numbers game, just doing it over and over again and maybe getting lucky? But what are some of the things that you learned along the way?
Look, I think it is a numbers game. I think if you focus on the process and the discipline, eventually you're going to get a deal. So it is just a matter of bouncing back. I mean, being happy that you get rejected and then just bouncing back and looking at another deal. Mm-hmm. I think another really important component is mindset. You really got to have a positive outlook and know that you're on the right track and not get down about it. And I was going to add one more thing. So I think the other thing that I really learned was in the beginning, you're learning the process. You're learning, you know, the math or the underwriting tool. And I think both Ryan and I had some experience with financial models. So we picked up the math relatively quickly. But what I think really made a difference was in the beginning, I was underwriting everything. And that was a really scattergun approach. But as soon as I really focused on the criteria and just focusing on those types of assets that fit within the criteria, I feel like we were much more focused. We didn't waste time on deals that would lead to nowhere. We didn't waste time on deals that we didn't really want. And I think that focus really contributed as well to the success.
Yeah, for sure. That makes sense. And yeah, congratulations on, you know, persevering and getting to do such a big deal for your first one, first of all. So what kind of institutional capital were you making relationships with, just in, you know, in broad terms?
Yeah, there's a number of, you know, joint venture and preferred equity funds out there. And again, it's very similar to the debt. You're going to have to pair the partner to the project and the needs of the project and what sort of leverage the project can tolerate. Because at the end of the day, you know, the preferred equity slug, it is additional leverage. They're, you know, paid right after the senior lender before the common equity. So you have to be conscious of what that leverage does to the project and how that adjusts the risk profile.
Yeah, definitely. And what did you find as successful strategies for making relationships with these types of groups?
Yeah, again, proactively talking to these groups and getting a sense of what their appetite was for the types of deals that they wanted to do, which really happened to align with our investment thesis and, you know, what we thought made up a good deal, which certainly helped. But, you know, the institutional investors, again, are very low risk investors. They're looking for stable returns on quality assets in very strong markets.
Yeah, definitely. Well, cool. I'm also curious, you know, in today's environment, obviously it's always a changing environment in the multifamily space, but right now there's a lot of changes happening with rent growth and inflation, et cetera, debt changes with the debt markets. So curious what it is that you're doing to kind of make deals pencil and work. I'm sure there's like obviously deals that are just not working, but what sorts of assumptions are you working in? I mean, obviously it's going to vary deal by deal, but wondering what you can share on that front.
Yeah. You know, it really comes back to the basics of underwriting and real estate investing. You know, you have to take the conservative assumption that you're going to sell into a worse market than you're buying into. You have to have, you know, a cap rate escalation and assume that although you're growing NOI, that's not going to count as much in the future as it does today. And I think now more than ever that's certainly a really important component of your underwriting. As far as rent growth, you know, we're obviously in very strong markets in Florida. I mean, we saw an excess of 30% rent growth last year. obviously that's not sustainable. So the key things we look at for rent growth are obviously supply and demand. We look for very supply constrained markets with a high inbound migration that puts a lot of demand pressure on rents, but also affordability. What are the jobs in the market? What is the pay? Are wages growing? What is unemployment? Because if you hit the affordability ceiling, you know, you can't continue to raise rents if nobody can afford to pay them.
Yeah, absolutely. And are you finding that you're having to be aggressive when you're going after some of these Class A deals? Like, is there any way you have to kind of balance being conservative versus being, you know, aggressive enough to win deals?
Yeah, I think the best way for that, you have to be optimistically realistic. Obviously, they're very strong markets, and there's a lot of data that says you can go ahead and be pretty bullish on the future of these markets. But you have to dig into the data and really constrain that with what's realistic and what's supported by numbers, as opposed to, you know, oh, we saw 32% rent growth. We're going to see, you know, 20% next year. You got to dig in and see what's driving that rent growth, what are the numbers behind that, and what's a realistic assumption.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So I'd love to hear also now about your other two, or the other acquisitions that you made last year. You said some of them were even bigger than the first one.
So we bought three, we made four acquisitions, but three of them were in Florida, in the Bradenton and Sarasota MSA. So three of them are kind of near each other. The second deal was a little bit larger, but it was a B-class deal. So it was actually mid-80s construction. It had much more of a value-add component to it. But then the last deal that I think Ryan mentioned that we closed for the year, which was in December, was a $73 million acquisition. And that one was a little bit different. So that was actually brand new. We bought it directly from the developer. Sometimes you got to get a little bit creative and find the value in some of these deals. And this one, it had a different kind of value add approach. It was a lease up deal. So when we made the acquisition, it was only 40% leased. So there was upside in that it hadn't been fully leased. What we also could see clearly was that the developers were trying to fill it as quickly as possible with cheap rents. They weren't using, I've lost the word, they weren't using
market rate.
They were below market rate just to fill it up as quickly as possible. So we could see that there was value add there as well.
For sure.
Knew the market was super strong. And actually, a proof point for that was that when we actually closed the deal, it was 100% leased and it was 99% occupied. So a lot of that upside came during the contract period. And then finally, just the area was really rejuvenating. This one's in Bradenton on the Manatee River at the north side of the city. And the city's building out a Riverwalk system. So the Riverwalk is in existence on the west side, and they are currently under construction building that Riverwalk east, which is an awesome amenity that we didn't have to pay for. And the Riverwalk goes right by our property, and we're planning to build a front gate on the property with direct access onto that Riverwalk. So when we added up all of these pieces, we were able to put together a genuine value add story, even though it's non-traditional because it doesn't have anything to do with construction or rehab. So that was a newer asset and a bigger purchase price, that one.
Interesting. Yeah, very cool. I mean, and how great to have a brand new asset in your portfolio with, like, you know, Class A type amenities, et cetera. Very, very interesting. Cool. I'd also like to ask you guys about your partnership. And, you know, it sounds like, you know, you've met through the real estate world. There's a lot of, you know, fish in the sea, so to speak. And so how did you guys decide you wanted to partner up?
So we were both part of the same mentorship group. We were both underwriting deals, looking for deals. And it turned out that we were looking in the same markets. So there was one particular deal in Jacksonville, Florida that we were both underwriting. I don't remember how we made contact originally, but we started talking about it together and started underwriting it together. That particular deal, we got far in the process, but we didn't end up winning it. But we both enjoyed the experience of working together. So after that point, we started looking at more deals together. And what we found was that we work well together, but more importantly, we shared a similar philosophy of what we thought constitutes a good investment. With Ryan's construction background, he's got an aversion to older buildings with lots of problems. So he was naturally more inclined to the newer buildings. With my experience as a passive investor, I've been in some deals that haven't performed well, sometimes because of the sponsor, but sometimes just because of the circumstances or the asset. So I also had this aversion to try to find lower risk offerings. And because of that shared philosophy, that similar philosophy, we tended to work well together, and we had the same kind of goals with real estate. And so it developed from there.
Very interesting. Cool. I like it. And I want to hear more about some of both of those things that you brought up with Ryan. How about let's start with your background in construction and an aversion to maybe some older buildings, et cetera. Can you just tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, it really comes down to execution risk. If you're doing, you know, a heavy reposition, a heavy lift, you have to hit a project schedule. You have to hit a project budget. You have to be really good at estimating project costs and then guessing, you know, unforeseen costs. So the change orders don't eat your project budget, and then keeping that project on schedule so you can generate the returns you need in the timeline that you laid out in your business plan. And that becomes increasingly difficult in an environment with these supply chain hangups and constantly waiting for materials, shortage of skilled labor, and then the increasing cost of financing these projects. We can get a lot lower cost debt on, you know, a fully stabilized light value add asset than we can on a heavy lift. And then there's the component of these newer properties are generally located in newer neighborhoods. So they come built in with a better demographic. So you don't have these collections issues. The bad debt doesn't pile up. You have strong income to rent ratios already built into the area you're investing.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, I think it speaks volumes just that, you know, you have experience managing these types of budgets and are really just trying to go into assets that are going to be easier to manage and more secure from a risk perspective. So very interesting. And I want to hear now, Warren, about some of the sort of mishaps that have happened in, as you were a passive investor.
Yeah, there are probably two categories that I recognized I didn't really like. One was some sponsors are just not very organized or not very good at running a business or actually managing an asset. I think there's a lot of focus in the industry on acquisitions and everyone gets very excited about acquiring a big multifamily asset. But really the hard work starts after you get the asset because you've got to follow a business plan and make it perform. So I did have one investing experience where the plan didn't seem to go to plan at all. And the sponsor, I think, just either took their eye off the ball or maybe they weren't very good at managing a business. Or I don't know what the cause was, but it really woke me up to the fact that it's really important to vet the sponsor and make sure that they have a track record, like you mentioned earlier. Make sure that they're very likely to be able to execute on the plan that they're selling to. I think the other experience that was a real wake-up call to me was poor communication. So there are a number of sponsors out there who might actually be doing a great job, but they just don't talk to you. And that was very frustrating as an investor. So when we decided to build a business together, we were very conscious about those two points. We wanted to be as professional as we could be in the operations of the asset, but we also wanted to create the best possible investor experience. I think growing up in the corporate world, I'm used to a certain level of professionalism. We're taught to be, you know, professional when you work for a big global company. And we want to try and recreate that experience. So I know we're a small business and we don't have the resources that some of these big institutions have, but that's our goal. We're always striving to give that institutional kind of experience.
For sure. And just for some clarification, when you say the sponsors wouldn't talk to you, like they wouldn't respond to your emails, they weren't accessible, they weren't providing updates. What did that look like?
They weren't providing updates. Every now and then there would be an update, but it wouldn't be timely. Often the communication in those updates was very poor, you know, like one or two black and white pages from they'd obviously put together a little PowerPoint presentation, but it was maybe one or two slides. For some reason, it was scanned in black and white and then emailed. I mean, it wasn't very good communication at all.
I see. And what about responsiveness? Like, would they respond to you?
Yeah, I in that instance, I didn't want to be a hassle. So yeah, when I sent an email, they would respond, not necessarily straight away. After a while, though, when I sent follow-up emails, yeah, the responses got even more delayed. Oh, I think they were willing to engage, I mean, to anyone that was complaining or wasn't very happy. But I don't think it should ever get to that, really. I think they should be proactive on the communication side.
Yeah. And after that experience, curious, like what kinds of information you're sending to your investors as updates and how often?
You could probably answer that, Ryan.
Yeah. So we send out monthly updates to our investors. We have kind of an asset snapshot that we send that tracks our key performance metrics against our projections. And then we send the full financial reporting package every month. If we're doing renovations, we have a summary on renovation progress, as well as any photos of any completed renovations.
Very cool. Awesome. Well, I'd love to hear what your kind of thoughts are about stepping into the market at this time in the market cycle, you know, buying, I guess it seems like you bought your first assets in 2021. Is that right?
We got the first one under contract end of 2020.
Okay. Yeah. So 2020, 2021, last couple of years, where do you feel like you're going to be changing your outlook? Or I know we talked about not underwriting refis, and what else do you think you're going to be adjusting just given the future? No one has a crystal ball, but what you see is coming up.
We've been talking about this together a lot the last couple of days. I think we're both very bullish on multifamily right now. There's not enough housing. There's incredible demand in certain parts of the country. There are genuine demographic shifts in certain parts of the country, which create great markets for multifamily. The concern right now is pricing. Pricing's gone up so much just in the last 3 months. And at the same time, interest rates have started to move up and are projected to go up much further. So I think our approach could probably be described as we'd like to be buying more deals, but right now we're pretty cautious. We don't want to be overpaying for deals because clearly the cost of capital is going up right now. And we think that should be factored into the pricing. So, you know, we're bullish on the market, but it's definitely a function of price.
For sure. Yeah. Very, very interesting points. Anything to add to that, Ryan?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, the debt market is shifting, but the fundamentals of real estate and real estate investment haven't changed. Real estate's a great asset class. Like Warren said, the fundamentals of demand for housing, you know, the supply chain and, you know, the supply constraints in these markets hasn't gone away. And with interest rates on the retail side, you got to think about in buyers for single family homes. Anybody who is currently a renter and looking to buy their own home, their cost of owning that home and their mortgage payment comes up too. So I think we're going to see continued and maybe increased demand pressure as people possibly looking to move into their first home are now going to be priced out of that market.
Absolutely. For sure. There's going to be a lot of kind of commotion in the markets, I think, with these rising interest rates. All right. Well, I thank you so much, you guys, for coming on and just learned a lot today and appreciate your perspective and all the work that you're doing. It's really awesome stuff. So thanks for coming on. Please share with the listeners how they can learn more about you and your firm and anything else you want to share.
Thank you. So the best way of learning more about us or getting in touch is to go to our website. It's equityyieldgroup.com. You can find out more about us, some of our projects. You can sign up for our newsletter or sign up for the investor intake and you'll find out about some of our future deals.
Awesome. Well, definitely check these guys out and sign up for their list, everyone. Thank you so much, you guys, for coming on the show. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.